Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how the companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode, John Corley is co-founder and CEO of Spanish Point Technologies, a Dublin-headquartered company that builds enterprise software products and intelligent Microsoft-native cloud platforms and that modernize complex organizations at scale. He has over 30 years' experience in the technology sector, beginning his career as a software development in early 1990s. In 2005, he co-founded Spanish Point Technologies to provide innovative software solutions to medium and large businesses based on emerging Microsoft technologies. Within 2 years, the company was named Microsoft Worldwide Partner of the Year, recognizing its technical depth and early market position and establishing a long-standing position within Microsoft's enterprise ecosystem, which remains central to its delivery model today. Under John's leadership, the company is entering in the next phase of global expansion with a clear focus on scaling its product portfolio and advancing enterprise digital transformation through cloud and AI. John, you are very welcome to the podcast.
Thanks a million, Aidan. You make me sound very old.
I thought you were going to say very experienced, yeah. But okay, that as well.
Right.
Nice, easy one to start for you. Explain to a novice what Spanish Point actually do.
Yeah, I think at its simplest level, we take complex problems and use the latest technology to solve them to drive business value. So those complex problems could be the need to understand your product catalog in a very large company and try and understand, you know, whether you've got the right product information in all your different factories around the world. It could be around calculating and providing a really good user experience for online mortgage applications in the Irish market. All these different kind of problems are things that we look at and say, how would we apply technology to make those, you know, sometimes super complicated problems seem simple and solve them for the business.
So it really is multi-industry in terms of your end customers.
Yeah, we started out as a company really focusing on our understanding of the technology and how it could be applied across all industries. Along the journey, we've become expert in certain vertical industries along the way, and we might talk about that a little bit later, but we've got vertical experience in the music industry and also helping other software companies. But in one of the core parts of our business, we help medium and large companies solve these complex problems using the latest technology.
Right. But from the start, you've been closely aligned to Microsoft. So, you know, I suppose, tell me the pros and cons of partnering with a big organization. And then, you know, how does that relationship develop over time? Because obviously, you know, being there for as long as you have been, you know, how it was at the start is not how it is now.
Yeah, no, 100%. And you know, the whole technology industry has changed over that period of time, and the big tech companies, Microsoft being one of them, have changed radically during that time as well. So for us, in the very beginning, it was to try and be relevant to Microsoft. We saw what they were trying to do. Like when we started out, we saw that Microsoft were beginning to commoditize enterprise software and to begin to focus on enterprise. Prior to that, it was an operating system company and, you know, sold Microsoft Office. Mm. Everything they licensed was based on the number of users, the number of desktops. That was their whole
bums on seats.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so we were trying to be relevant to them by helping them break in to the enterprise and helping kind of assemble these innovative solutions using different components Microsoft were building. But Microsoft, when we set out, just weren't an enterprise computing company. They were an end user computing company, and they were trying to break into the enterprise. And we kind of went with them along that journey, and we became more and more relevant over time. This year we're their largest reseller of Microsoft Azure, their big cloud platform. So over time, your relationship changes. You become more important to them, and it's a more symbiotic relationship. But also, you know, it's been brilliant for us. They're a very partner focused company, and that approach has helped them as well as helping partners like ourselves.
And to what extent has you know, and it sounds in the day and age we're talking about AI and everything, like, you know, the move to the cloud sounds like it was so long ago, but how important was that move to the cloud in terms of their quest to be enterprise and you know, an enterprise software company, but also opening up your ability to actually generate all these applications in a cloud framework?
Yeah, it was really important. Like, when we started really focusing on the cloud, Microsoft were nowhere. Like, the Amazon was gigantic, Microsoft were just starting. They were way late to the cloud from a compute perspective. But they had a lot of ambition, and they gradually improved the offering, and they linked into their partner network, which I think was a critical difference between themselves and some of their competition. And we saw that trend early on. Like, for us, from a company perspective, we're a software development company at heart. Everybody apart from sales and marketing and finance are all software developers, yeah, myself included.
Yeah.
And the beauty about the cloud is that everything became software defined. So, you know, it was prior to the cloud really taking off, we would go and talk to customers and identify a really good solution that would work for them. But then we'd be impeded by the IT department saying, okay, we need to get servers, we need to go through, you know, some network stuff, so come back to us in 6 months and we should have all the infrastructure so that you can start doing it. But the cloud got rid of all of that. So infrastructure became software defined. There was this idea that software is eating the world, you know, where everything became software defined. And because we're such a heavy background as a software company, that really suited us. And that helped us kind of propel our adoption of the Microsoft cloud across all our customers and helped us become much more relevant and important to Microsoft.
You know, when you look at it though, you know, from the Microsoft perspective, why do those big organizations work with companies like a Spanish Point rather than just going direct and doing it themselves? Is it end market expertise they don't have, or what is it?
Yeah, I think it's a good question, and some companies don't, or some companies do a little bit of it, but not really enough. I think ultimately Microsoft realized early on in its back in the Bill Gates era that partners help you scale. And if you deliver a platform products on top of which people can innovate, then you can scale much more rapidly by allowing your customers or your partners to innovate on top of your platform. So rather than try and control everything and then be limited in lots of different ways around your ability to scale, your knowledge of specific domains, you know, like, there, we've a very specific set of knowledge expertise in the music industry, but like, is there lots of people in Microsoft who would want to build up lots of expertise in the music industry? Probably not. Would they have spotted the opportunity in the marketplace for that? Probably not. But because their approach has been, we'll provide platform technology and encourage innovation on top of that, through supporting partners, I think that's why they do it. And I think that's a very good reason to do it. And I think when as we talk a little bit about AI, which is kind of the next wave after cloud, that same pattern, I think, is going to emerge and is already emerging.
Yeah. So it's almost, you know, to use the analogy, if you own the toolbox, you don't have to make all the tools that are in the toolbox.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, where is the customer value created? Mm-hmm. Like, if there's lots of different tools that all have their different pluses and minuses, but can all be used to achieve more or less the same thing, where is the differentiation in customer value? It's in the people using the tools and building the final stage, the final end product. And in the case of what we've been doing in the cloud, it's those innovative applications that drive real business value. The business user will know that it's on the Microsoft platform, but they won't really care Do you know what I mean? They don't really care what sits underneath it. They care about is the value that you can
They can plug into it. They can use it. They don't care who necessarily is producing it, just that it gets their problem solved.
Exactly.
Yeah. You mentioned the music industry as a big expertise. Where did that come from? And I suppose, you know, what does it look like in real terms?
Yeah, so before I set up Spanish Point with my business partner, Donald, we worked in a really good indigenous Irish software company called Mentex, set up by a famous Irish entrepreneur, Dr. Mike Pierce. And, you know, when I was there, I was one of the youngest, amazingly, software developers straight out of college. So I knew all the modern technology, and we won the contract to build the Irish Music Rights Organization, or the first CMO's very first system. They'd broken away from PRS, so they'd demerged, I guess you'd call it, from the UK, and they needed their very first system. And I designed that and developed it back then. So that was maybe 30 years ago. Since then, I obviously set up Spanish Point. We had got a lot of expertise. We built a lot of custom-built systems for similar organizations around the world in the music industry, learned a lot about it. And then about 5 to 7 years ago, started to build our own product called the Matching Engine. That's a kind of an off-the-shelf kind of ERP type system, mm-hmm. specifically for copyright management organizations around the world.
And where does that change now with the likes of Spotify and everything coming through? How does that shift the landscape?
Yeah, like so what our system does at a super high level is it gets data on how music is used in a particular market, like Canada, for example. And that data comes in all shapes and sizes from different people who use music. Spotify would be one. YouTube background music for Minecraft videos, you know, massive amount of music is used. Radio stations, TV stations. So we get all that data into our system, and it's billions of rows of data in a month. And we also get the information on all the license fees that those people who played that music have paid. And then we figure out, for all the music that was played, who owns the copyright. And we divide the music, the money proportionately across all of the plays of all of the songs, and then subdivided by the people who own the copyright in each thing. So ultimately, at the end of the process, the system generates a whole pile of checks for people who are electronic payments these days for the people who wrote the music and own the copyright.
That's a massive. That, like, when you just think about the sheer quantum, particularly something like Canada or America or something like that, where there's so many different music outlets, if you will, or you know, that people are doing.
Yeah, no, it's the data volumes are gigantic, like billions of rows, like I say, and actually that leads into, you know, well, how do you solve these complex problems? Mm. So a single play on Spotify is worth a tiny fraction of a cent. I think it's four decimal places. So, you know, if a human being has to look at that to figure out which song it is, they've lost money.
Yeah.
So that's where our product, taking the advantage of the latest cloud technology combined with a whole bunch of AI capabilities, kind of solves a real world problem.
Yeah.
And like this year, our customers are on track to pay through our platform $1.3 billion in royalties across the world. So, you know, even though AI sometimes gets a bit of a bad rep, you know, when people say, how is this useful? You know, it's an integral part of that system that's essentially paying music creators, and not always the big famous ones who earn loads of money in a lot of cases.
On Grafton Street that's busked and has put on his own album, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the money is way more important to them than it would be to Bono, with the greatest respect to Bono.
Mano,
you know?
Yeah, that's true. That 0.00001 cent, you know? Don't think it's going to move the needle. Switch to the actual setting up the business. Was it always your intention to go out and set up something on your own?
I've done lots of things in kind of semi-intentionally.
Right.
I've always kind of thought that would be great to do. And if, and you know, when I worked in a business, like, you know, it was a great business, I thought, well, these things are really good and I would do lots of this stuff. And these things maybe are not so good and I would avoid doing some of this. So I always kind of had that in mind. Like, I grew up in a family farm, which, you know, I never appreciated at the time. I kind of hated working on the farm. It was, yeah. All my friends were out in Lavin going to pubs and stuff while I was on the family farm. But you learn a lot about business growing up that way. So then when I went to college and then had my first job in the IT industry, I was kind of looking at it from the lens of, you know, how does this look from a business perspective? So in one way, I always wanted to kind of have my own business. In another way, I didn't have a very firm plan. Like, I didn't have, you know, like some people write down in their little journal in two years' time, I'm going to set up this business.
There is that idea out there where, you know, there's people who consider themselves, and they go, you know, oh, well, I'm an entrepreneur, and they go and try find a business where, and then there's another group of people who find a problem or have a product or something like that, and the business just actually creates itself out of that rather than they're kind of looking to have a business.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot to be said from learning by working in companies, you know, to understand, you know, business in all its different dimensions. You know, there's understanding the kind of sales and customer relationship part, which is super important. There's understanding the employee management, you know, having a kind of a motivated team who, you know, really understand what their sense of purpose is. There's understanding the finance, managing, you know, you can be a busy fool, I think, is the saying, and not make any money. So there's a whole bunch of things that there's no way you're going to come out of college and have a good understanding of those things. But if you work in a business, probably a small to medium sized business, I would say, for a few years, that will give you a good
understanding. You see the jacks of all trades working around.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the route I took. I was very fortunate to have a great business partner, Donal. We both looked at each other and said, you know, why don't we do this for ourselves? And it was literally as simple as that.
Right.
Where we just went to look.
And when you had that co-founder, was it good in that, you know, as you said, I always say to people, you know, when you're an entrepreneur and you're setting up a business, you have lots of various different hats to wear, as you've outlined. It's handy having somebody else where you can go, okay, you're wearing the following three hats, I'll wear the other three hats, and you kind of have that complementary skill set that gets everything done.
Yeah, no, it was really good. And also, like, it's a little bit stressful running your own business, and particularly in the early days, setting up your own business. So having somebody to share that with and, you know, share the load was really good for us.
What would you say is the culture at Spanish Point?
Yeah, like it used to be that, you know, I used to listen to people talking about company culture and I used to think, like, what are they talking about? Like, you know,
what a load of tosh.
Yeah, well, like, you know, you kind of, you're able to influence the culture when the company is smaller just by talking to everybody meeting everybody, going for lunch together. But as the company gets bigger, you begin to think, actually, this whole culture thing is really important because the thing that made us different and made us successful in the beginning is really important to keep going. But it's harder to keep that thing in place as the numbers get bigger. So you have to be intentional about it.
Yeah.
So for us, you know, like we've worked quite hard to try and understand what it is we want to be and a little bit of what we don't want to be too. You know, so we want to be specialists. We want to be deep technical experts. We have inner values. My favorite one is doing things the right way, not the easy or quick way. Because we kind of believe that idea around engineering excellence adds a lot of value in the long term. In the short term, you can take shortcuts, but those shortcuts always catch up with you.
Yeah.
And if you can really drive people, actually, I heard a thing just yesterday, which is a great question to ask at a review, which the chap I talked to, he borrowed it from Steve Jobs, so it's been stolen twice now, is to ask somebody, you know, after you ship a product, you know, are you proud of that? Like, you know, how do you feel about what we've delivered? And I think that's a great question because, you know, like there's lots of metrics. Did we deliver it on time? Did we deliver it on budget? Even is it selling?
Yeah.
But how do we feel about it is actually quite an important question too.
But there's also then the flip side of that is to look at it and you go, you know, it's not necessarily about getting the absolute best mousetrap out onto the market. So you don't want to get just any old mousetrap, but you can't wait to get, you know, it 100% perfect that you say to yourself, I'm happy with it, but I'm really 100% happy with it.
Yeah, I agree completely with that too. Like the key thing is you can have the best plan in the world and you can think that this is the way people are going to use your software and solve the problem. But as soon as people are using it, you realize they're doing it in a different way. They have different constraints. And the problem you thought was the most important problem is actually maybe the third most important problem. And these other two problems are more important. So I think shipping early, getting your product in front of customers, and, you know, really listening and trying to understand what's important to the customers. I think the customers will always tell you what's wrong. They won't necessarily tell you what the solution is.
Yeah, yeah. Because they're relying on you to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but like getting that early feedback and iterating quickly, I think are really important. I think like dreaming up the best possible product in complete isolation and only shipping it when you think it's perfect is a bad idea. I think that are you proud of it idea though is more about the engineering. You know, like, so do we feel we've done a good job as engineers, which sometimes is the under the hood capabilities, but they can have a big impact on the user experience.
And then kind of tied to that then, you know, and I suppose as you get bigger and bigger, this becomes the question, you know, does the level of innovation fall as you get bigger and bigger as a company? And if so, how do you stop that in an industry where innovation is really, really important?
Yeah, like, again, it's a tough thing to be certain about, because even defining innovation sometimes is, it's the kind of thing, you know it when you see it.
You can't tell beforehand.
Yeah, exactly. So for us, things that we really focus on are, hiring curious people who want to use the latest technology and who, even if they weren't paid to do it, would be doing it anyway as a pastime in a different way. And I think that's really important. I think having that product mindset, so always looking at problems that we solve once off for a customer and saying, hey, would that be a product? Could we make that into something that we could have a broader kind of appeal? And engendering that culture in the company, that if somebody kind of sees something that they've done that they think has a wider appeal, that they'll be supported. It'll be seen as, even if it's not a great idea for a product, that the fact of bringing it forward and saying...
And having the discussion around.
Yeah, is a really positive thing, because that discussion kind of lets everybody see, okay, this idea of innovating is quite important in here. So if I want to advance, I need to be, you know, sticking my hand up and saying, hey, these are things that I think could work in a wider context.
But is there I always wonder about this, particularly for very innovative companies or in innovative industries. Is there, you know, when you get successful and you get it, you know, you start building your palmares in terms of that success, is there a risk that you get distracted and you start going, you know, innovation is great to a point until it becomes, you start going down, you know, multiple cul-de-sacs somebody needs to step back and go, no, that's a cul-de-sac, that might not be, go with that one or not go with something else?
Well, I'm of the school that you should try more things than is maybe, you know, sensible,
right,
and then pick the things that would work. I think you're better off trying some things and seeing if they work than analyzing endlessly and, you know, doing market analysis and, you know, getting commercial reports drawn up about, you know, different aspects of the market. I think those things have their place too, but I firmly believe in in trying some things. Some of them will work and some of them will not work. And as soon as you see that something's not working, you can just stop doing it. But that itself develops a bit of a culture of innovation in the company. So, yeah, so even though you're not like just focusing on one thing in a very steady way, I think doing that actually protects you from that downside risk, especially in the high tech industry, because the tech is changing all the time. If you just focus on one thing, become really good at that one thing,
the market has moved on.
Yeah, that one thing will cease to be important in three or four years, even less. So, and like some of the biggest tech companies around, have fallen foul of that. You know, they've just focused on the thing that's making money now and that is likely to make money in the next year. And they're not really playing with what could be really important in 2 to 3 years' time.
The when it comes to staff and things like that, where are you in terms of hiring talent or developing it from within?
Yeah, like we've always tried to kind of find young people pretty much straight out of college. We've got a lot of internship programs and graduate recruitment programs with a couple of key universities, and to try and find the very best people and convince them that actually working in an indigenous tech company is better for them than joining some large multinational. Mm-hmm. Now that conversation has become a lot easier in the last 3 to 4 years.
Why is that now?
Well, I think young people now and entrepreneurship is actually much more fashionable than it was 5 years ago or even 10 years ago. Like it was almost a tiny bit grubby, if I could say, setting up a business. Yeah.
Is that because you can't get a job?
yeah, except a proper job, like one in the bank or something. But so that's one element of it. You know, and there's a lot more kind of entrepreneurs on social media, and people kind of see that kind of culture and kind of like the idea of it. I think the big tech companies have become a little bit unstuck culturally. The do no evil stuff has been abandoned pretty quickly.
Pretty funny that.
I think that the next generation of people who want to be involved in software and tech, see the benefits of working in a smaller company and trying to learn how to build a software company that is international in focus, but from Ireland. So that's what we kind of focus on. So we try and develop people. We have brought in experienced people and they've added a lot to the company. But my bias would be to find the best young people and train
and
them.
And mold them as you want them.
Exactly. Yeah. And learn from them, right? This is the, I think a mistake that can be made is to kind of say, well, I'm going to get young people out of college and I'm going to give them all my wisdom and they can do what we did. Mm. But actually, you want them to teach you about what they know, they've learned in college that wasn't around when you were there. We've got a generation of people now who are, AI native, digital citizens, who've grown with this stuff, who are used AI as part of their day-to-day social.
In their DNA.
Yeah. And they'll, even though some of it might not be commercially viable, some of their ideas. Yeah, exactly. Some of their ideas and the way they think about things will become important. So I think having a really open mind around what we can learn from the next generation, as well as vice versa, is really important.
You said you're mostly software engineers in the business, and you're a software engineer yourself. Could you go back to the shop floor as a software engineer?
Yeah. Well, like you look at it with rose tinted glasses, right? Like I look at it, and think, God, it'd be great. Like I'd love to dedicate a long weekend to just working on this kind of problem. I used to be a C programmer, which is famously a kind of a fairly unforgiving language. But in reality, I think I've a better job than I did when I started, I it's one of the things that you often thought if I retire, I might go back and do a bit of hobby development. But again, I think, you have to realize when time has moved on and you better do other things.
Rings, exactly. Well, on that point then, you know, what do you think is the hardest part of being the boss in the business?
There's tons of good points, right? Mm. And I think people quite rightly don't have a lot of tolerance for people in pretty privileged positions complaining about their loss,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they're first world problems.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, any problems I have are small problems in the overall scale of the world. But, but one thing for sure is that, you know, sometimes you hear about the things that are going really well, but you always hear about the things that are not going well, or the problems. So it can seem like a big chunk of your day is an endless stream
of
problems and stuff like that. But, you know, every problem is a kind of an opportunity in a way. And I think if you train yourself in terms of your mindset to look at these things as opportunities and look at, you know, whether it's an opportunity to show other managers how you would deal with this situation, or whether actually what this, if it's a customer problem, what they need is a whole new approach to solving the wider business problem, and maybe there's a sales opportunity in that for us. So I think you just have to train yourself to look at it through a different lens. But for sure, that would be probably, for me, one of the biggest kind of downsides of being in
the charge. Yeah. Do you get a huge amount of repeat business from customers?
Yeah, no, we do. We've customers, one customer in the Kingspan Group, really famous entrepreneurial Irish business. I think they were our very first customer in Spanish Point when we set up, I think, 21 years ago, and they're still a customer today. Okay. You know, customers like Imro have been with us for long, long periods of time, I'd say maybe 16, 17 years. And the kind of thing that we're in, like, things are always changing, like problems are changing.
They always have problems that need solving, really.
Exactly, or the problem that you'd solved before has become different. Mm. Or has a new nuance, or you found that, hey, that actually worked for this problem. Mm. We had another problem which we didn't think technology could solve, but maybe it can. And then technology is changing. Yeah. You know, you can't sit still, and you can't have the same software that was running 20 years ago, you know, still running today. Yeah. It will create all sorts of problems. So there's a constant renewal there.
Yeah, you recently took on money for the first time from an outside source. This was private equity, and don't worry, I'm not going to ask you how much you're in like that, right? But talk me through the process of deciding how much and who to take it from.
It was new, and actually, I love doing new things. Like lots of people say, it must have been very stressful, but I actually love doing it because it was something like completely new. You got a chance to do different things and just see different perspectives on business. So the rationale for doing it, like, why did we take, you know, we've grown organically, bootstrapped, I think is the word people use for the business, like right the way along. So when we started to turn more from a pure services business into doing our own core products as well as services, we funded that all ourselves. So literally the shareholders sat around and said, okay, we're going to take a chunk of this money
thought you were getting, but we're not going to give it to you.
And we're going to spend it on developing, you know, some products that will take 2 to 3 years to generate a return. And that was actually a really successful strategy for us, way beyond what we expected it would be. But we find ourselves at a kind of unique moment in time, I think, and a unique moment in the marketplace. Like in the music industry, we're the market leader, but we're only less than 10% of the market. The market is emerging, and if we want to be the Coca-Cola of the music industry, which I dearly want to be, then we're going to have to accelerate what we're doing. We're going to have to spend more money. We're going to have to invest more. So that was one kind of element. And in the digital transformation part of our business, because of our AI credentials and our ability to deliver real-world AI solutions, we're one of four partners Microsoft have in Ireland and the UK that are part of what they call the AI transformation program, or AI transformation offer. And what that is that if we find an opportunity with a customer, Microsoft will pay us to build the solution. The customer won't have to pay anything. They'll just have to pay for the running of the solution once we build it. And to be one of four partners across the whole of UK and Ireland with that capability, it would be a shame if we didn't take real advantage of it. So I wanted to do something that would allow us to really grow our business, particularly in the UK, take advantage of this next coming wave of innovation around AI by solving some of those problems and to really power on in the music industry. And to do that, you know, you couldn't do it just by, you know, you could do it over the longer period of time, but you might miss the boat at that point. So that was the motivation, essentially.
Right. And what was, you know, once the decision was made that, you know, in terms of outlining why you wanted to do it, how much you needed, what was the courtship like in terms of, you know, you go into this, you're ultimately realizing that, A, it might not be just money that the private equity firm is bringing in. Yeah. So, but also you need to know that you're going to have to be able to work with them because they're now going to be big shareholders. And is it, you know, in the past, the shareholders could sit around the table and say, listen, we're doing this with the product.
Yeah.
You know, they're a different, it's a different animal you're dealing with now.
Yeah.
So what's the courtship like?
Yeah, so we had a bunch of PE firms who were ringing us up, kind of their version of outbound marketing, you know, saying, hey, you know, we see your company, we think there's an opportunity for us to invest. And I just thought, well, what is the chances of the best fit for us just having picked up the phone and rung us up? Probably not very high,
no.
So we said, well, if we're going to do this, let's do it properly. Let's get a specialist company that will advise us and let's run a process and pick a whole bunch of companies that we think would be a good fit and go over and explain our story to them and then just go through a formal process where people put in their bids. And that's what we did. I spent 2 days in London. I think it was 2 days. It felt like about a week. Going from one private equity firm to another, repeating the same 1 hour long explanation about what we were doing, and got some great questions, got some not so great questions too. But then we had a very competitive process with a bunch of bidders, whittled it down to three strong companies. Picked the one that was the right combination of value. Like, I'm not going to say value doesn't come into it.
Yeah, either. Of course
it does. It does come into it. But also cultural fit. Like, they felt like people that we could work with. And they had a specialization in companies that had really focused software areas. So they kind of had that idea that we have, which is you're better off having a lot of depth in a small number of areas.
Certain silos,
So that made a lot of sense. They're UK based, have a lot of contacts in the UK, and we want to really expand in the UK, do some acquisitions, which is a thing we've never done before. Again, something I'm really excited to get involved in. So yes, we picked them based on that. Took, I think, 8 months in total. I'm terrible at dates. So, you know, I'd say my CFO will point out I'm out by about half a year
since this,
but it seemed like it took 8 months to get from the very beginning to the very end. And while there's been some stress along the way, it was mostly a really positive experience. You get to learn how to articulate the value of your business. Makes you think about, like, people ask you questions that make you think, you know, am I wasting my time doing this stuff?
Yeah.
So that's broadly how we did it.
And you know, when you think, you said obviously value is important, but how much more important is that idea that your new investors are aligned with, both culturally aligned, but also aligned with the destination and the path that you're going on now?
Yeah, I think really important, like understanding our vision for where we want to be in the music industry and where we want to be in the next wave of digital transformation through AI is really important. And, you know, the people we chose seem to really get that. You know, they seem to really almost believe more that there was more opportunity out there than what we saw. Because, you know, when I talk about value, like, there's the value now, but there's the value we're going to create on the journey over the next 5 years. So I'm more focused on the second part than the first part. First part's important, but the second part is where we can really create an impact.
It is. You talk to entrepreneurs sometime, and they're kind of almost focused on, oh, well, I want to own 40% of this business or 60%, and I give it away. Bam. And I kind of say to them, listen, you know, you own 100% of it now, right? And it's worth whatever. It's worth X, you know? Do you care if you own 30% of something in 5 years' time that's worth 10X?
Yeah.
You should actually think about the 30% and 10X, not the 100% of X today.
Yeah, no, and like, you know, everybody is doing things for money to some extent, right? But it goes broader than money. You're trying to have an impact. You're trying to, change the way the music industry works, or really kind of become a big player in the AI transformation space. So having those effects is the kind of mission that we're on. And the money always follows in business. Solving customers' problems is the primary thing. And if you do a good job of it, the money will come along afterwards. But I think, you know, if you're focusing on the money first, you're not going to really get...
You're not building a long-term sustainable business.
Exactly,
Do you obsess about the small things?
I do. I'm terrible, actually. Because, I just think... I'm a great believer, like, if there's easy stuff that you don't get right, look at it. And again, I'm a sucker for those LinkedIn little kind of, I find myself going down little rabbit holes where you're watching people talking about sayings and stuff. But so I just think there's some things that you need no talent to do. And this is not my idea. It's memes all over the internet. But, you know, turn up on time, working hard, having a good attention to detail so that you're not sending off stuff that's got like sloppy mistakes, stuff like that. I think if you show that you're good at the kind of easy in quote stuff, then you'll have people will trust you a lot more with the difficult stuff. But if you mess up the easy stuff,
they're kind of going, this is slapdash.
Yeah. How can they be credible at doing the complicated stuff if they can't get the simple stuff done correctly? You know, I know that's a bit reductive, and there's lots of people who are brilliant in a certain field. But I think in terms of advice to the younger me, that will be one of the things that I've learned on my journey, and that was something I really believe in.
Are you fast or slow when it comes to decision making?
Fast. Yeah. Like I kind of, you know, I like to understand the data, but I don't like to spend weeks.
Analysis paralysis.
Yeah. And asking tons of people. Like I like to ask people I really trust and just get their views, but really quickly, I wouldn't be wandering around Dublin asking 20 people that I know and spending months on something. I think you'd be better off spending your time and energy on trying it out and seeing what happens in reality.
And then are you data-based or gut feel when it comes to your decision-making?
Yeah, mostly data. Obviously everybody has an instinct.
Yeah.
And you kind of learn to, over time, when you're talking to people, and maybe it's a customer supplier relationship thing, and you know you're trying to see are they going to buy something, or you can kind of tell by all these little signals that you would call gut feel, but it's actually your brain is processing all of these signals
as data.
Yeah, exactly. So I've learned to kind of trust my instincts, because over time that you've learned and you've built experience. It's one of the advantages older people myself actually have.
Yeah, you and me both.
Is we've had a lot of time for that kind
we've
of
a lot of miles on the clock.
Data processing. But in general, yeah, I like to see the numbers. I like to understand, you know, evidence as to why we shouldn't do something, and then decide quickly.
And then who have you sought advice from?
Different people. Like in some ways, the best advice I get is at home from my family. You know,
best sounding board out there.
Well, you know, when you're in charge of a company, sometimes people are reluctant to tell you that this is a mad idea, yeah, or you're wrong. Whereas my family in particular has got no problems.
No qualms about that.
Telling me I'm crazy. That's a mad thing to do. You shouldn't do it. So they're one. And then I've met lots of entrepreneurs through different networks I'm a member of. And there's everybody, even though we're all very diverse and all quite different, there's something quite similar at the core of every entrepreneur. Yeah. And you can kind of, you know it when you see it. And so I value their advice and stuff. Yeah. So I'd often ask people.
You said earlier that you know, all the growth so far in the business has been organic, but with this private equity money coming into, there will be a switch to potentially some M&A, and you know, it's a different mentality running a business organically to then incorporating it into it. So what's your approach to the M&A going to be?
Yeah, like I first of all, like, I think it's going to be a really important part of what we do if we want to accelerate in the UK. And we've a presence in the UK, which we're going to build up quickly. But if we want to really accelerate, we're going to have to do some acquisitions. And I think having a good cultural fit, will be important. So people who kind of value the same things as we value, people who kind of have the same desire around customer outcomes and stuff that we have, even if technologically they're not 100% aligned, and even if in some ways they're quite different than us, I think if culturally they're the same, and if they value the kind of customer outcomes in the same way as we value them, then I think that will be a good fit. But yeah, we'll have to work really hard to make sure that they understand that they're joining a family, and that they're, you know, equally as important as the people who've been in the company for a while. So yeah, it's something, again, I don't know a lot about. I'm going to learn as I go along, but I'll have a lot of help that will help me get there.
Do you hate losing or love winning?
Oh, I hate losing.
Do you?
Yeah. Like, winning, you feel good for maybe an hour, maybe a day, but losing, I can be thinking about it for weeks.
Right. And you said something earlier about getting a product and out and asking somebody, are you proud of it? So, you know, do you celebrate those wins as an organization? Those successes as an organization.
Yeah, no, we do, and a lot of the time we try and do it with our customers. Like when we have a really successful win, you know, where a system goes live, and some of these systems take years, you know, because they're doing this big complicated thing. You have to integrate with all of these different providers. So, yeah, so we definitely do celebrate, but in the way, and that's really important for the team, we've put in long time and effort, but the way I just think about it personally when I'm driving home in the car, I kind of move past the win thing pretty quickly to the what are we going to do next. Whereas the lose thing, I'll be thinking, what were the mistakes we made? Yeah. When did we make them? How can we fix them? And, you know, yeah, so I think, well, I don't know, actually, you'll be able to tell me what the most common answer for entrepreneurs
actually
is.
It actually breaks down quite 50-50. It does actually break down 50-50.
Well, so you've shattered my illusion. Entrepreneurs hate losing, but...
No, a lot of them, it's funny, there are certain ones who, and when you talk to them, the rationale is, why do you love winning? I mean, because I know on the path to winning, I'm going to lose a few times. I'm going to lose along the way, and I can't get hang up on that.
Yeah.
So that's why they like to keep going forward, right? Yeah. Whereas others go, a bit like you, going, yeah, but it's, you know, a win is a kind of a soft term high, a short term high, and then you're kind of, do you? Some of the people have said they learn more from their losses than their mistakes. So because they're all the time trying to develop themselves, and therefore, you know, when they win, they kind of go, well, maybe I was just lucky, as opposed to being good.
Yeah. Well, I'm not in the maybe I'm just lucky category yet, but so.
You mentioned something earlier on too about you know, your younger self. But what advice would you give to young people today?
Hey, I think it would be, don't believe the hype that you know, AI is going to take all jobs and there's no kind of future for young people in the workforce, which is kind of a message that's out there at the moment. I don't believe that to be the case at all. And I've got a whole bunch of reasons for...
Well, let's talk, because I actually have a question here, and I say I can't let you go without getting your views on AI in the future. So let's amalgamate them all together and tell me what it is.
Yeah, well, like, so... And every analogy people use is flawed, right? Because nothing is ever precisely the same. But I remember just about, actually, when spreadsheets were first invented, Lotus 1-2-3 and then Excel. And... at that time, there was an idea that the whole accounting bookkeeping industry was gone. Mm. That, like, now one person with a spreadsheet can do what 50 people doing traditional bookkeeping. Younger people listening to this will have no idea what I'm talking about.
But there'll be a few that aren't quite sure what it's done about when it's spreadsheets and things like that.
So that was the preconceived idea. But there's more people in the accounting profession today than there ever has been. It exploded because you could analyze things more efficiently and more cost effectively. People analyzed lots more things. Yeah. And now businesses are incredibly data-driven in comparison to the way they used to be, mostly still powered by spreadsheets. And I think what AI is going to do, specifically for software development, so specifically talking to software engineers, is it's going to enable people to write more software more cost-effectively. There will be more software in the universe by a multiple than there was before this transformation. And software will solve problems that it wasn't economical to solve before. But that creation of more software with more efficiency, you'll still need more software engineers to do it. And people who kind of get a good understanding and have a love for how software works and understand AI and how that can help, I think they'll be really valuable in the next wave.
It's funny. I was in the States 2 weeks ago meeting companies, and I met a load of technology companies, and that's definitely the mantra is changing. Originally, it was AI. You kind of go, well, I can produce the same amount with less people. Now the mantra is very much around, well, how much more can I produce with the same people that I've got if I enable them with the technology that I have?
Yeah, no, 100%. And can you solve brand new problems that weren't solvable before? Like, can we solve that... you know, a single play on Spotify is worth a fraction of a cent, so we can't have a human being looking at it. Like, that's a problem that needed to be solved. And, you know, using AI, it's possible to solve it really well. So I just think there'll be lots more opportunities for people in the software space. The job will change, though. It's not going to be pure coding. But pure coding wasn't really the fun part. It's the
or the best
solving.
Use of their time, probably.
Yeah, exactly. It's the kind of problem solving, the understanding what the problem is, like looking at it from different dimensions and trying to understand what the nature of the issue is before you start trying to solve the problem. They were always the most valuable parts of writing software, and still are today. But it's even more so when some of the heavy lifting around the coding part is AI assisted.
The other thing, I suppose, I'll get your view on, you know, from my side of the fence in terms of stock market recently, you know, since the start of the year, you know, all of the big SaaS software companies have seen their share price get hammered because everybody's saying, oh, well, I won't need to go to an enterprise software or a SaaS provider anymore. You know, Johnny in his garage can develop the app on Claude, right?
Yeah.
And like, I think it's fundamentally flawed, because I think companies need to be dealing with enterprise software companies because of accountability, auditability, all of that other stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, having one point solution might be great if it's cheap, but no business just needs one point solutions.
No, and really large enterprise solutions are incredibly complex, and they're solving incredibly complex problems that have to be kind of defined and understood first. They have to work for lots of different customers, so be very configurable. So the people building them need to understand the differences from one market to another, or different ways of processing data. So yes, it's possible for us, and we're seeing a real boost in productivity in our core development team around the music industry to ship more software more quickly. But understanding what problems need to be solved is still a vital skill. So yeah, I you know, like anything in tech, like there's a lot of hype, and then, but underpinning the hype, there's actually some
good technology,
hardcore kind of big seismic changes. But it's well known, right, that like people underestimate the change in the long term, but overestimate it in the short term. And I think that's what's happening here.
I know it's a bit early to be talking about this, given the fact you just raised money, but do you have an exit strategy in mind?
Not an immediate one, no. Like, you know, the focus at the moment is really to do those two things that I talked about. Like, so what I really want to get to is, you know, is that kind of Coca-Cola status in the music industry. That's really be impactful if a small Irish company can be the global leader for music industry software around the world. And then, you know, really driving into the UK with their AI transformation business. So that's the goal for the next 5 years, is to really create an impact. And then anything that follows from that,
we make that decision then.
Yeah.
Has fear of failure ever been a driving force for you?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. I think it spurs you on.
Yeah.
You know, like I think, you know, like I'm always thinking, you know, geez, John, don't screw this up. You know, we've got to such a really good position. Yeah. You know, and I know some people say, you know, you have to only think positive thoughts. And like, you know, and I'm sure it works for some people, but you have to kind of do things
you
in your
own way.
You have
to be real in the real world.
Yeah, and you know, it really works for me. If I say like, John, get your ass out of bed because this is an important meeting.
Yeah.
You need to get prepared. You know, that gets me out of bed, gets me thinking, and is generally a positive.
Yeah. And how do you feel about what you've already accomplished in the business?
Yeah, I think, well, it's definitely not me. You know, it's a whole team of people. And, you know, what we've achieved together, I think, has been really impactful. Like to walk into really big companies around the world and just walk through their building and see everybody using the software that we designed and built.
Does that give you a buzz?
Yeah, that's the absolute best.
Buzz, is it?
Yeah, because when you and you meet people who've never met you, and you're almost like a mini celebrity to them, because you're the person.
You've solved a problem for them.
and like they're using your software and they'll tell you, I don't like this bit.
Yeah.
You know, and you think,
can you move that button over?
Yeah, but so that's really impactful. So yeah, so I'm really grateful for the team that we have in terms of what we've achieved. But I genuinely believe we're only getting started. Sorry. And in some ways, the temptation, if you're a tech company in Ireland, is to get to a certain scale and then
plateau.
Get out completely, you know, declare success
and move on
And retire. And I've no interest in doing that.
Very good. Right. We'll come to the black book question. As is always the case, I have no idea what's going to be ahead of us.
It's
right?
Looking a bit battered. The
it is,
black
I know.
Book,
it's,
you don't mind
it's,
me saying.
See, we're on number 80 now at this stage.
Oh, wow.
So 80th episode is about to be released next week. So, okay, this will be an interesting one for you. If someone points out your weakness or a mistake you made, is it your inclination to explain it or accept it?
I probably wouldn't say much at first at all.
Would you? You'd internalize it for a while.
Yeah, exactly.
Would you?
Yeah, and think about it for a while. Yeah. So I'd probably do neither is the reality. I'd say thanks. That's feedback's always good.
Good.
And then run off and stew on it for a little period of time before deciding whether they were wrong
or whether.
So they'll have gone by the time I've figured it out.
Yeah.
So I won't be giving them any immediate feedback
one way or the other. Very good. Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, John Corley. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and we will see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning, the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.